It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we get the buzz on a Milwaukee barbershop that's helping to boost kids' literacy while getting their hair cut.
First, 3 weeks after an investigation by the Capital Times into conditions at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King, state lawmakers have voted unanimously for an audit of the facility.
Cap Times investigation looked into concerns voiced by residents, employees, and volunteers of the King Veterans Home, which is the largest nursing home run by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs.
According to the report, residents are being neglected while the facility rakes in millions of dollars and even sometimes transfers surplus funds to other veterans programs.
Caitlin Farrell is covering the story at King. She's the Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me.
So you wrote the report that first highlighted conditions at the King Veterans Home. What prompted that first look into it?
Sure. So that story actually came after a story that I wrote in May where I examined the spending practices at the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs and had looked at their staffing levels there and how much they were spending on veterans benefits and the Veterans Trust Fund, which is a fund that funds those programs. So after that story ran, I had heard from some folks who had concerns about King, and then I just started making calls from there, and it kind of snowballed from there. So I think maybe once people saw that I was covering this agency or looking into things there, the tips started to come in. So,
and you spoke with people who were very closely connected with King, residents, staff, and also volunteers there. What were you hearing from those different constituencies?
Sure. So, well, a lot of the things that I outlined in my second story then about King was just a concern that the home was increasingly admitting very, very ill residents that they really struggled to care for because of prolonged staffing shortages there. And so we had this issue with many veterans coming into the home, complex mental and physical ailments, a shortage of staff that has been going on for a very long time. And this is while, you know, people had a lot of questions about how the veterans home had such a surplus, was able to bring in such excess revenue, so much so that millions was able to be diverted to fund other programs. And so that was really the bulk of the concern, which I had outlined in my first story.
Well, and Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary John Skokas had this to say about the issue at King.
We've done a great job, our team, our employees. It's saddened to see some of the things that are in the media, the allegations, but we're driving on. It's what we get paid to do, and we'll work through this like anything else. If there's things that need to be tuned up, we'll tune them up.
So, Caitlin, he's talking about if there are things to be tuned up, which makes it sound like overall things are in good shape. There might just need to be some tweaks made. As you look at the care that's being given at the King facility and how long it seems to have been a problem, do you think that's an accurate assessment?
Are you asking whether I think the secretary's assessment is accurate? You know, I mean, I'm not sure that I'm in a position necessarily to make an editorial judgment on that. I mean, I certainly respect the secretary's position. His statements that he made yesterday during the audit committee hearing is you know what I have been hearing the whole time, and I have really strived in my reporting to offer you know an equal platform for that. There is a tension that I have found in my reporting and in my talking with people. And what I have seen since I've been to King several times, and so there is definitely a tension there between what I'm still hearing from people and what Secretary Skokas is telling lawmakers. And you know, I think I said this before on this show. I don't doubt that many people have a positive experience at King, and I you know, I admittedly did not speak with all 700 residents there, and so I don't aim to necessarily you know project anything that might be inaccurate upon the entire home. However, the people I have talked to that come from a variety of positions, and I'm still hearing from residents, and I believe they're reaching out to several lawmakers as well. Senator Luther Olson has mentioned that he has heard from people who are corroborating much of what I've reported. And so that's mostly what I would say to that. You know, I'm still hearing from real people. I quoted real people in my story who have names and stories of their own, and what they're telling me in many cases has not matched what I've heard from that agency. But I'm interested, you know, as I've said, to you know, be really equal opportunity and be very fair and thorough in how I'm presenting the information I receive.
We're talking with Caitlin Farrell. She is the Capital Times reporter that has been uncovering conditions at the King Veterans Home and the type of care that veterans are receiving there. Secretary Skokas also said claims of wrongdoing are unfounded because he points to the fact that federal regulators have consistently given the facility high grades for its care, but the home also recently received a serious federal citation. Can you give us a sense of who's coming in and looking at King and what they have found?
Sure. So King is regulated by a couple different agencies. They're regulated by the federal VA, which comes in and does surveys. They're also regulated by the State Department of Health Services. It's DQA, the Division of Quality Assurance. And that's a state agency that routinely inspects nursing homes in the state. And so yes, those folks come in, they give inspections. What Secretary Skokas most frequently has invoked is the home's five-star rating. So the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid provides nursing home ratings for every nursing home in the country, I believe. And so he's right in saying that, you know, each hall at King is given a different rating, and those halls over the years have been given very good ratings, 4 stars and 5 stars. 5 stars is the highest rating that you can get. However, one thing that I did point out in my first story, and I'm going to be following up on and looking at as well, is really how these ratings are determined. It is true that for the CMS 5-star ratings, there is an inspector that comes on the campus and looks at things in person. But, you know, a big part of the overall score a nursing home may receive relies on information that they report to the federal government, and that information is not audited or checked by a third party. So it's kind of a complicated formula to look at, you know, how these scores are made, what the methodology is, and kind of gets wonky and in the weeds at that. But I guess I just say that to mean that there's more behind the scenes about how these ratings are done. The New York Times has also done some reporting on this as well. So that's what I would say to that, and I hope to dig more into that to help people understand that more.
So yesterday, Republicans and Democrats from both chambers of the Wisconsin legislature voted unanimously about how to address the King nursing home situation, and they decided that an audit would take place. When will this audit begin, and who's going to do it?
So it's my understanding that the audit is going to begin pretty immediately. It's going to be done by the Legislative Audit Bureau, which is a nonpartisan government agency, you know, used by the legislature. State Auditor Joe Christman spoke at the committee hearing yesterday, and he talked about how this audit was really he cast it as a medium-sized audit, so be I think around 6 to 9 months. And you know, much of what Mr. Christman said was that he's really open to, though, exploring whatever lines of inquiry he will happen to come across there. So it's a medium-sized audit, but he's open to having that be larger. And much of the sentiment that lawmakers talked about was really wanting to make sure that this audit would be done in time for budget considerations for the next biennium, so that they get an understanding that if there's deficiencies or things that they want to fund, things that they want to consider, that, you know, the audit will be completed in time so that they can then have the answers they're looking for and use them when they're making decisions about the next 2 years.
Well, and you just mentioned budget and in terms of the state budget, but looking at the budget of the King home, they are actually currently running a $38.9 million excess in their budget. Why would they have that much money that is designated for the home and not be using it to provide a higher level of care? Is there any explanation that's come out for that?
Well, I don't believe there's been a full explanation for that. I mean, the Department of Veterans Affairs has said that they has emphasized that they have reinvested money into the home. And so they have, and I honestly don't have a clear understanding. That's another follow-up that I'm working on right now, but about how that actually works. And lawmakers asked about that yesterday as well. You know, they get money from a variety of federal and state pots, if you will, and no one really has a clear understanding then of how spending decisions are made, how they're prioritized, and what the mechanics of that actually is. And so, yes, you're right. They have this $1 million, you know, almost $40 million in surplus revenue, and it's unclear, you know, why that's the surplus at this point, and what, you know, what isn't being funded, or and what, how those decisions are being made. I mean, all that the agency has told me is that they do take the, a portion of the money that King makes, and they do reinvest it in the home. And they've cited various projects that they have spent money on, and I've reported that. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that there's really a very clear answer to your question at this point, which is what I'm interested in figuring out.
Well, Caitlin, we'll look forward to following along on this story with you.
Thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell, the Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter who's been covering the story about the veterans nursing home at King. Right now, think of a barbershop, and you might think of clippers and scissors and close shaves. A barbershop in Milwaukee is offering local kids a lot more than just a haircut. They may walk away with a book and free back-to-school supplies on top of a sharp-looking haircut.
Books in Barbershops is an effort to help boost literacy, when also to help close Milwaukee's pervasive black and white achievement gap, which is among the highest in the nation.
The program hopes to foster a love of reading in young children who might find themselves a little at loose ends after school.
Books in Barbershops is a partnership between city officials, the Milwaukee Public Library, and the owner of Chicago Cuts, a Midtown Milwaukee barbershop. Ronald Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts, joins us now. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica.
Well, first of all, can you paint a picture for us? How does this work? A child comes into the barbershop. What happens?
Well, you know, first off, you know, the main thing we're trying to do is close that achievement gap between blacks and whites. And, you know, I was just really trying to figure out the best location or the best way to reach them. And, you know, for the African-American community, the barbershop is somewhat like a country club to us. You know, we exchange a lot of ideas, energy, and, you know, that's just a great meeting place. So usually when a child first comes in, they're just caught off guard by the interior design. We invested a lot of money into the decor. You know, it really looks like you're walking into the south side of Chicago, from the L train to the downtown city skyline. Every child that's been in there, they told me that they, you know, don't want to go to any other barbershop but mine. And then we have a bookcase where, you know, we have comic books and, you know, different type of magazines from the Smithsonian Library, and, you know, just a large variety of different things. And, you know, we just try to make it fun for kids. You know, we have some books that are, you know, 10 pages long, some books that are 20, 30 pages long. But, you know, we just basically just try to make it fun for them, you know, just where it's not school books where they're trying to read up on history or geography.
How did you decide to get involved and bring this to Chicago Cuts?
Well, obviously I'm from Chicago, you know, with the name Chicago Cuts. And, you know, at one point in life, I really wasn't where I'm at mentally now. And sports really saved my life. And having different mentors, different coaches, and, you know, different people that helped guide me through life, it really helped develop me into the man I am today. So I have three sons myself, and my fourth son will be here actually on October 11th. And I'm just trying to, you know, just find a way for, you know, us to just, I guess, add value within the black community and, you know, just try to redirect their energy into something else, you know?
And so if a child comes into the barbershop and they see not only, you know, the stuff of the hair cutting and the look of Chicago, they see these bookshelves and they see comic books. How do you work with them about picking something they like and getting excited about reading it?
Oh, well, to be honest with you, the first step before we even go to the bookshelf, I actually have a 150-gallon saltwater fish tank that's in the wall, and I take all the kids over there, and, you know, that's a different aspect of education. You know, I teach them about the different types of saltwater fish. You know, first thing they say is, oh, where's Nemo? And, you know, we just kind of go over the different names, and, you know, I let them feed the fish, and I just try to get them comfortable within the shop. We have several flat-screen TVs, and we have, you know, different cartoons formed for different age groups. And, you know, I don't just take them straight to the bookshelf. We just try to, you know, get them comfortable walking around, have a good time. And then, you know, at that point, to be honest with you, they end up leading me over to the books. And then at that point, I ask them, like, what's your favorite, comic book character, X-Men, Batman, Superman? And, you know, really at that point, they just take over, and I really just follow their lead.
So it sounds like, in a sense, you're you're a guide and a mentor for these kids who come in. This is kind of a community place. It's not just a place of books or a place of haircuts. There's more going on. I mean, do you see yourself as a mentor?
To be honest with you, the reason that I opened up Chicago Cuts, you know, I'm definitely a businessman, but this investment right here, it was not really about the money. This was more so about investing into the minds of these young African-American kids. You know, I really do feel like a big brother, and, you know, it's just with this barbershop, this is like a hub for me to reach the masses instead of me by myself reaching out and trying to do different community service events at the YMCA or, you know, going to schools to speak or this and that. I have more control having my own business, my own land, and, you know, just my own environment for them. And, you know, think about it. You guys found out about me and reached out to me, and now we're on Wisconsin, you know, public radio. So I know that this is going into the right direction. And, you know, I've been getting a lot of people that come and visit, and, you know, everyone just supports me. And, you know, they've been asking me for ideas for what they can do in their community. And, you know, I got other barbershop owners in other areas. You know, we're trying to work together to, you know, basically just bring peace and bring education within the Black community.
And you launched the program, as I understand it, earlier this month in time for getting kids back to school. How's it working so far?
Man, it's working great, to be honest with you. I got people coming from all different type of cities. Like one of my barbers, his name is Cedric. If you want to follow him on Instagram, it's Ced the Barber. And he told me that a lady actually called him from West Bend, and that's about a 45-minute drive away from Milwaukee. And she said that she had a local barber for her son, but she just wanted to come check out the interior design. And she just really wanted to let her son and see what was going on. She just wanted him to just have the experience of walking through and just seeing everything that's going on within the area.
I'm talking right now with Ron Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts Barbershop in Midtown Milwaukee, and he's talking about a new program there to boost literacy by making books and school supplies free to kids. And these books that you've got there, you mentioned some comic books. So where do they come from? Are they donated?
Yes, we've teamed up with the mayor, Tom Barrett, Alderman Cavalier Johnson, and he's actually connected me with the Milwaukee Public Library, and they bring me a certain amount of books every so often, and if we run low, they'll restock it. But the way I basically set it up now, my barbershop is somewhat like a library, because some kids, they come in and they may take a book that day, and, you know, it's really just an honor system. I don't have any type of tracking to see what book was taken and what kid took it, but they usually come back for that next haircut appointment. They'll return that book and then take out a new one.
Do you ever have conversations with the kids who are reading through maybe a series in comic books about what they read?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, like, you know, that's the main thing, is just being a part, you know, because, you know, it's sad to say, you know, most of the African-American males, you know, they're, you know, either incarcerated or, you know, sad to say, some of them are, you know, not even with us anymore. They passed away. So it's a lot of these kids growing up without that guidance. So, you know, that's why I explained to you, you know, maybe ever since I started having kids and maybe I got, you know, more love around me and stuff, I really want to try to help as many kids as possible, because I just know the small amount of help that I was given from all my mentors and coaches, you know, it just helped develop me into this. And, you know, if I can just spark that idea in one of these kids' mind, I just know that they can, you know, I can create another one of myself, or, you know, someone better than me to, you know, really reach the masses and, you know, try to just create a positive change within the community.
Now, in the traditional education system and communities, usually the place where the stuff you're happening talks about, it happens, I should say, is the library. People go to the school library or the public library. They check out a book. What do you think is different about your setting that it's getting kids to open up and read more and maybe be more receptive than they might have been?
Well, you know, the libraries, you know, you have to be very quiet. You know, that's a place where you do significant amount of studying. But, you know, within a barbershop, it's more fun. I guess that's the key. I'm bringing more, I'm bringing a lot more fun and a lot more of this 2016 up-to-date, you know, swag, or, you know, just the, you know, just everything that's going on within the Black community. It's not boring. I'm making sure that they're having a good time, because, you at the end of the day, I want to see real results. You know, I'm not... you know, I really want to make sure that we really affect the masses in the right way. So I'd say the difference is we make it a lot more fun. And, you know, we may take a break. Like I said, we have several flat screens. We have a PS4 in there. You know, we may end up playing 2K17 with the kids. And, you know, and even when they put the book down, we're talking about, man, so what do you want to be when you grow up? You know, and just trying to spark that idea so they start thinking about it now instead of, you know, they're 18, 19, 20 in college trying to pick a major.
Do you plan to do any kind of tracking with this, see if the kids who are part of your community there at the books and barbershops, whether they do go on to score better in school or go to high school and college, see if it's having an effect?
Well, I think I want to really just let the program kind of go through the grunt period right now. We just want to really just get the name out there and just let people know what's going on. And then I would say within a couple of months, maybe within the school year, we'll probably start to do the tracking within like second quarter, third quarter of grades. But, you know, right now I don't think that we've reached the amount of people yet to do the tracking. I want to just make sure that we really just get it across the city and try to get as many kids reading. And then once I get more people to come in on a regular basis, then I'll probably get in contact with their schools and, you know, give out rewards. Or, you know, so if someone increased their GPA, you know, you get free, like five free haircuts. Or, you know, I'm going to try to figure out some type of incentive to make them want to learn. And, you know, even have, you know, like contests within the barbershop. Like, let's say on a Saturday on one of our more busier days, I'll have five kids, you know, and whoever can read this book the fastest or, you know, whoever doesn't mind reading this book in front of the group, you'll get, you know, this amount of haircuts or, you know, we'll figure out some type of incentive form to make the whole process fun.
And Ron, just briefly as we wrap up, what would you say to other business owners who might be interested in taking on something like this?
Well, if anyone is interested in doing that, you can definitely reach out to us on our website, www.chicagocuz.com, you know, our Facebook page, Yelp page, anything. But, you know, feel free to contact me. You know, teamwork makes the dream work. Anyone that wants to reach out to me and we try to build this up within the city, that's what I'm here for. You know, I'm definitely trying to just make a change within the inner city.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. You enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. That was Ron Bell, the owner of Chicago Cuts Barbershop in Midtown Milwaukee. And he joined us there to talk about a new program to boost literacy by making books and school supplies free to kids. Faith, religion, and politics have been intertwined for years, but our next guest says that how they interact has changed and that the ways that Americans find their religion has changed too.
Kenneth Woodward joins us now. He edited Newsweek's religion section for nearly 40 years. His most recent book is called Getting Religion: Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
So your book, Getting Religion, starts with President Dwight Eisenhower and ends with President Barack Obama. Why start with Eisenhower?
Because Eisenhower was president at a time when the United States was at its most religious. In the 1950s, just to recount for a minute, 98% of people said they, when asked by pollsters, that they believed in God. They backed it up too. They were in the churches and synagogues on the weekend. They built more churches and more synagogues in the 50s than at any time before or since. Half the Catholic school kids were in Catholic schools, which is not true today. Protestant Sunday school was a national institution. Eisenhower was proclaimed by the Republican National Committee to be not only the president and not only the commander-in-chief, but also the spiritual leaders of our time. So there was an intertwining of patriotism and politics at that time that we haven't seen since.
So how much would you say the religion of a presidential candidate has played a role in campaigns and elections, say, in the 20th century?
Except for the negative one against Kennedy as the first Catholic, not at all. Not at all. And I would say, furthermore, that while there is a relationship between religion and politics, the whatever the belief system of a president was, it has absolutely no connection to foreign or domestic policy. I mean, one could argue that Woodrow Wilson was a pretty categorical Calvinist, and that characterological aspect of his religion would be is one reason why he was holding out for the Treaty of Versailles for total surrender and all of that. But there really wasn't. And I know they talked about George Bush Jr. Mentioning religion so much, and there were great fears, at least on the left, that there was he was going to institute a theocracy. Well, that's ridiculous, and he didn't. And if there ever was one, you'd want to point to Eisenhower.
So you're saying that the religion of any particular president has not really shown to impact their approaches to different types of policies, but do the voters realize that, or have voters historically taken into account what a president's religion is and how they feel like maybe his values would match with their own?
Well, religion and values are two different things. We all got values. We don't all have religion. And if we have religion, we don't always have it. We can have it in a very tepid sort of way. The best line on this I heard was from Eugene McCarthy. He's a good friend of mine. He's probably the only really intellectually informed Catholic ever to run for president. And Gene used to say that there were two kinds of religion that were tolerable in Washington: strong beliefs vaguely expressed and vague beliefs strongly affirmed. And I think that's pretty well true. And in the book, I apply it to, in this case, to Romney: strong beliefs vaguely affirmed. Obama was vague beliefs strongly asserted. So that's kind of my take on it. What the pollsters do is, after the fact, in exit polls, they'll say, well, tell us what you are and how you voted, in effect. And they'll tell you after the fact how Catholics or evangelicals or whatever voted. And there will be appeals to those constituencies. Trump, for example, has tried to appeal to evangelicals, and he's not a, you know, quite seriously, he's just not a religious man. Hillary is, but as I describe it in my chapter, in fact, I'm going to have a piece in the Wall Street Journal this week about this, the Methodist moment in the Democratic Party that began in 72, too long to talk about here. But she's a serious Methodist, but and Methodism can be a very activist religion. They are the ones that gave us prohibition, for example. And so there's a sense of, we know what's good for you. And I think that's part of her personality. It's a little off-putting to a lot of people.
We're talking with Kenneth Woodward right now. He edited Newsweek's religion section for nearly 40 years, and we're discussing his most recent book, Getting Religion: Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. And Kenneth, you mentioned John F. Kennedy a little while ago, and he was one candidate who faced a lot of questions about his Catholic faith, what it would mean were he to be elected, whether his loyalties would be split between the Vatican and the people he's representing. Let's listen to him answer a question about that in 1960 when he was running against Richard Nixon.
Article 6 of the Constitution says there shall be no religious test for office. That's what was written in the Constitution. Jefferson, Washington, and all the rest, they said every American will have an opportunity. Now, you cannot tell me that the day I was born it was said I could never run for president because I wouldn't meet my oath of office. I would not have come here if I didn't feel that I was going to get complete opportunity to run for office as a fellow American in this state. I would not run for it if in any way I didn't feel that I could do the job.
So John F. Kennedy is calling on Article 6 of the Constitution that says there is no religious test for being the president. But is that really the reality? Is there some kind of a religious litmus test that presidential candidates are expected to meet?
Oh, there used to be. I don't think so anymore. Look, what you have to understand is until Kennedy, well, actually till Al Smith in the 1924, there were a huge majority of Protestant Americans who thought that this was a Protestant country. They genuinely feared in 1924 that a Catholic might become president and maybe challenge Prohibition. Prohibition died anyhow. There really was. When Kennedy ran, I tell the story, it's too long to tell over the radio, of how Billy Graham and Norman Vincent Peale and others secretly met and connived to prevent a Catholic from becoming president. Obviously, and the irony is, Kennedy wasn't a very good Catholic. He was a tribal Catholic. It was part of his being Irish, and his father certainly didn't take it seriously, and although Bobby did. Anyhow, that once a Catholic was president, that was the end of it, and it's not an issue now. I think in the 50s and in the 60s, if somebody was of no religion, that would have been a problem. I don't think it's a problem today, as a matter of fact. So there really isn't a religious test. L.A. Stevenson ran in 52, he was a Unitarian, and that was considered a little weird and not quite American enough. So I think those kinds of attitudes are gone. Unfortunately, among the young, they're not very well versed in religion. They couldn't tell you if I mentioned somebody was a this or a that, they wouldn't know what that meant.
So, Kenneth, I'm going to push back a little, though, because you were talking about Kennedy and being a Catholic, and that was a big deal. And then once he was elected, it wasn't a big deal anymore. But I'm not convinced that that means that that people are ready in general to look at candidates without zeroing in on, say we had a candidate who we have had Jewish candidates, not nominees, but candidates, but a Muslim candidate or a Buddhist or a Hindu and people running to be president. Can you actually see that not being an issue in a pretty polarized religious context right now?
Well, Joe Lieberman was a vice presidential candidate. One of the things I liked about him personally was that he was serious about being Jewish. He was a religious Jew, and he was connected religious institutions in the Jewish community. That's less than half of American Jews are. They're the least religious group in the country. As for Muslims, this is all brand new, or a Buddhist, or something like that. You may say, you know what, you're talking about a very, very small slices of the pie. We're just getting used to having them over here. But the kind of Buddhism that survives in this country is pretty tepid, pretty lukewarm, and I don't think it would. I don't think it would matter. It may be a matter of curiosity. Mitt Romney ran. The Mormons have been around for since the middle of the 19th century. He finessed it by, and I talk about this in the book, he finessed it by deflecting all questions to the church's public relations apparatus and didn't talk about his religion. And the funny thing is that the religion was deeply serious and deeply shaped by that religion, and his piety was that way. And polls showed from Pew that 80-some percent of Americans knew little or nothing about Mormonism when he started to run, and the same percentage after he had run said the same thing, hadn't learned anything. So you and I are going to differ a little on that. A Muslim, me, for obvious reasons, for what's going on with terrorism.
Well,
but almost anybody else, it wouldn't matter.
Well, and that's interesting because an aspect of the Obama presidency has been the very firmly held belief on the part of some Americans that he is, in fact, Muslim, and that is used as a strike against him. And so In a weird way, it's not what his religion is that's being used as a litmus test. It's what is being projected on him, and yet it is mattering for a lot of people.
Well, I would disagree there, too. I think people don't like the people who suspect he's a Muslim are the people that don't like him anyhow. And that's if they suspect he wasn't, you know, the birthers and so forth. It's the reverse. It's we don't like him. Here's another reason not to like him. Here's why we think he's other, you know. I had a friend of mine who knows better, and he kept calling him Barack Hussein Obama. He says, I'm sorry, that's his middle name. His mama called him that. And the effort was to suggest that he wasn't wholly American. And I think it's a case of people using that because they already don't like him.
We're talking about how religion and politics intersect in America, and especially how the religious beliefs of presidents have come into play. And we're talking with Kenneth Woodward, whose most recent book is Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Is the religion of a presidential candidate an important factor to you in deciding whether or not you're going to vote for them? And if it is, what is it about their religion that you're looking for in particular? Is it specific policy positions, just a sense of ethics and morality, or just the fact that they have a faith that's important to you? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about how religion and politics intersect in America, especially when it comes to choosing a president. Kenneth Woodward is with us. He edited Newsweek's religion section for nearly 40 years. His most recent book is called Getting Religion: Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you care what religion a presidential candidate is? Is it important to you? Would you ever vote for a candidate who said they did not follow any particular faith? What about your own religion? And have you continued in the faith of your parents and your family, or have you gone in a different direction? And how significant a role should religion play in our nation and how it's governed? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kenneth, we have some callers who would like to join the conversation, so let's go first to Jerry in Hamburg. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I'm just wondering what he thinks would be the reaction of the voting public to someone who was an avowed atheist running for president.
And actually, Jerry, I'm going to, before Kenneth responds, I want to ask you what you think would happen.
That's one of the things. I'm not sure. I think it would cause a lot of problems. I think people have a bias against non-religious people.
Thanks for that, Jerry. And Kenneth, what do you think?
Well, maybe they have a bent for religion, which most people do. I still think that's a taboo that hadn't been broken. But look, I think we've already seen somebody like that, and it didn't make any difference, okay?
And who was that?
I don't think Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is Jewish. He's not religious. And he calls himself a socialist. He really comes from a whole different immigration tradition of Central European socialist Jewish immigration back a couple, a generation or two ago. At least two, I would say. If somebody was like a Dawkins or a Chris Hitchens, whom I knew pretty well, Christopher Hitchens, who was an argumentative atheist, which is to say he really doesn't like religion, that person would have a problem because most people in this country, whatever level of seriousness, are religious.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go into that aspect, Kenneth, of your book. It's called Getting Religion, and you look exactly at that in terms of how Americans come to their own faiths now as opposed to maybe earlier generations.
Well, I think, first of all, if you the reader picks up this book, they're going to see the word Protestant, Catholic, or Jew appears in none of the chapter titles because the concepts I use, like entrepreneurial religion, movement religion, embedded religion, are the ways you bring religion and culture and politics together. And so it's a rather different look at things than people usually make it. When I talk about evangelical religion, I don't really talk about, I talk about it as a entrepreneurial religion. If you understand that aspect of it, you see what makes it different from other forms of Christianity. And then, of course, there are all the alternatives to religion. There are therapeutic alternatives, but there were a lot of them in the 70s and the 80s, which is a really weird time. People still have to contend with the problem of death, and there were alternative ways of trying to cope with death. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is a name to conjure with. She was big on death and dying. So I'm looking at the whole culture and just not, you know, religious enclaves.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, and Jackie in Milwaukee joins us. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I think religion, specifically Christian religion, has a great deal of impact on our choices for president. When they had the questioning of the candidates, they all had to agree with the Genesis creation story. They all had to state that they were Christians, you know, and even though Mormon had to say, well, that's Christianity as well. And they all make appearances before the conservative religious organizations to make their pitch that they believe in Christianity and they're going to uphold the Christian beliefs when they get into office.
Thanks for that call, Jackie. Kenneth?
I just disagree, that's all. It's not the case. Occasionally, if they ask a loony question on television, those debates about religion, it's a softball question that comes out, you know. So it's simply not true anymore that you have to be, you know, answer as a Christian. I think those days are over with, even though your caller may feel that it isn't. The Republicans, I mean, they go before a lot of groups. It is quite true that the people who register as non-affiliated, is the largest single group constituency within the Democratic Party. And yet Hillary Clinton is a very serious Methodist. Her positions on social issues are drawn very much, and I talk a lot about this in the book, from the positions of her church. And Donald Trump will knows that there is a evangelical constituency in the Republican Party, has been since the start of, let's say, 1976 in reaction to Jimmy Carter, and he has to talk to that. He's just not a religious person. He doesn't act that way. There's nothing about his values that would be remotely Christian or evangelical Christian. So that's a constituency to be courted. And in the Democratic Party, it's always been go to black churches. That's a sociological phenomenon more than anything else. So, if you want to get to the black voter, you go to the black church. It's just the way it is. And but I don't think that somebody has to feel that religion is pushing politics in that way. It really isn't. You go to where the people are.
But I want to say, Kenneth, that Donald Trump, who, as you said, is really not and has not been a religious person in his life, he felt the need to hold a press conference stating that he was a Christian, and he has appeared in black churches as well. So doesn't that say something? Because Donald Trump doesn't seem to feel pressured by much of anything to say things that he is or isn't. He is still feeling that pressure.
Oh, wouldn't put it that way at all, as a matter of fact. As I said to you, the evangelicals have been a strong constituency within the Republican Party. He decides to run on the Republican ticket. He's got to speak to that constituency. Just like in Jack Kennedy's era or Lyndon Johnson's, you had to speak to the labor movement, the labor leaders. No different. Or the people that really, the engine that runs the Democratic Party when it comes to presidential politics is really the abortion lobby. This is a no-no. You're not supposed to talk about it. But anybody that gets Planned Parenthood's, handout notices, they're like the old labor leaders who used to, you know, man the phones.
And I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Kenneth, thanks so much for being with us today. Kenneth Woodward's new book is Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. You can comment on the Facebook page. Well, we've turned a corner today. Goodbye, summer. It's the first day of fall.
Right. It's kind of sad on the one hand. It was a beautiful summer. But on the other hand, you know, we live in Wisconsin. I live in Wisconsin partially because I like seasons. I like the way things change. Mm-hmm. And I'm into the idea of bonfires and sweaters and fall baking. What about you?
I actually really love the quality of the light in the fall. There's just kind of a warmth and a glow and a goldenness about it that just gives everything kind of a magical, warm feeling.
It's beautiful, but the light kind of makes you depressed. reminds me of winter's coming. I think that is the thing I'm going to miss the most about summer, is just being drenched in sunlight.
It's true. And the days get shorter and shorter. But there are so many great things. I mean, anywhere in Wisconsin, but certainly if you live in the northern part, you get to see gorgeous fall colors. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much, the smells of fall. I don't know. I'm pretty excited.
And are you going to be doing some fall baking?
Quite possibly.
Maybe. And bringing it in to share with others on
possibly.
Central Time?
Possibly. And, you know, we talked about pumpkin spice yesterday, so we could always make some pumpkin spice cookies or muffins or something.
Sounds good. Well, what about you? Are you happy about fall, or are you still mourning the end of summer? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.